Accession number 28361, Reel 10.
General Julian Thompson, Reel 10. I think you were saying that you had your 3-inch mortars, but you weren't using them because you weren't doing live firing.
That's right. On this exercise, it wasn't live firing, so the 3-inch mortars were in support, and the umpires would ensure that, for example, a troop. Remember, a troop in those days was the equivalent of a company in that organisation. So if a troop was about to put in an attack, the umpire would ensure that the troop commander had made a proper fire plan with his mortar fire controller, who was there, and also with his notional FOO, who wasn't there.
Well, you have to use imagination.
Exactly. Yeah.
What about enemy? Were they all imagination or were
I think a troop was detached to play the enemy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you remember seeing anything of the locals while you were in the deep desert? Was there any contact with Libyan?
Not much. The most extraordinary thing about being in the desert was you'd think you were there on your own, and people would appear selling you oranges and things like that. Or riding a little donkey or camels, of course. So you did actually see them, but we didn't have much contact with them, no.
Indicate you weren't very happy with the Champ, apart from the fact of being a good cross-country vehicle, but what was wrong with the Champ?
The problem with the Champ was that it was very difficult to maintain because it had been built deliberately to be very easy and quick to waterproof. And so the engine had all sorts of bits on it to make it waterproof, which all had to be taken off in order to change a sparking plug, more or less. It had an intake which was rather like a snorkel on a submarine, which was folded down and you put it up when you wanted to wade, and it also had the suspension which I alluded to earlier, being four-wheel independent suspension. There was a huge amount of trouble with the oil seals on it, which kept on going, and it had been designed, I think, with amphibious operations in mind, not just for the Royal Marines, but also harking back, as far as I remember, to events in Northwest Europe, river crossings, crossing the Rhine, all that sort of thing, in order to produce a vehicle that would be a better jeep than the jeep. And in fact, it was continually breaking down and used to give the poor old MTO the most frightful trouble. But it was hugely fun to drive, because you would sort of drive at 80 miles an hour across the desert with all the wheels, you know, doing this independently, and you were sort of sitting level.
What were the rest of the men in? Were they in three-ton trucks?
Well, my platoon were in Champs,
yes.
Or Land Rovers. Yeah. The rifle troops were in three-tonners, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
What was the higher organisation beyond the platoon? Were you part of a headquarters or support troop?
No, I was. The support troop was my next highest organisation. And yeah. Support troop in those days consisted of the machine gun platoon, the mortar platoon, and the assault engineer platoon. Mm. You'll note there was no anti-tank platoon at this stage. Mm. And we didn't have an anti-tank weapon other than our shoulder-launched bazookas. The 3.5-inch rocket launcher, and then there were the five rifle troops, which were the equivalent to companies, and a commander headquarters, of course.
Mm. What was in the headquarters? Was that simply the command group?
Of support troop or my machine gun platoon?
Of support troop.
A support troop was just a small. Command group. There was a troop commander and a sergeant major and a troop quartermaster sergeant and a couple of stormen, because the troop, of course, didn't operate as a troop in the sense that its assets were all divvied up out to rifle troops in support, and the troop commander travelled with the CO as his support weapons advisor. And he was quite an experienced chap who'd been in Korea, actually. I learnt a lot from him. He was a very fine soldier, my troop commander, who'd fought in Korea with 4-1 Commando with the Americans.
It really sounds as though this support troop was an administrative organisation rather than a tactical one.
Absolutely, yeah. You didn't fight as a troop.
And,
unless we were doing something which we'll come on to later, which is which is operating in a counterinsurgency role when we became a rifle troop.
Yeah. What about your what about the commando headquarters as a whole? The headquarters troop, was that?
Well, the commando headquarters was very much like an infantry battalion headquarters. You had the CO, the 2IC, the adjutant. In those days, there was no ops officer. The adjutant was the ops officer. Ops officers didn't come in for a long time later. Then you had the quartermaster and the paid master, the doctor, padre, assistant adjutant, and all the usual sort of cooks and bottle washers that you expect to find in a headquarters.
Would that be where the INT section was?
Yeah, the INT section was in
and
commando,
signals.
And the signals platoon was in. It was in the yes.
What signals did you have in your troop?
I had radios to my sections, so each section of two guns had a radio to me on my machine gun platoon net, and then I had a radio on the commando control net.
So you would go directly back to.
I went back to commando to commando headquarters. Yeah.
Not to troop.
No, no, because the troop was dispersed. Yeah. Mm.
Did these wireless sets function effectively?
I can't remember which ones they were. They were. I think it was a 31 set. I think it was called. But I'm not quite sure about that. And then I had my on the commando net. I had a thing called a 62 set, which was a vehicle borne set, which actually was a Second World War generation set, which had wet batteries, like a car battery, and that was an HF set. So it had quite decent range, and your signaller, if he knew his onions, could get through over quite long distances. It didn't work terribly well at night because I think I'm right in saying the tropospheric thing comes down and you can't bounce radio waves off it.
Like skimming a stone on a pond.
Exactly. Yeah. And the sets worked reasonably well in the desert. Mm. The 30, well, I can't remember what the range of the 31 set was. It wasn't much. I mean, you're talking about 2 or 3 miles.
Mm. But would you wouldn't need more, presumably, if you
not to my sections, no. But I'd needed more to back to commando headquarters, because I might be anything up to 10 miles away from them.
Well, was the 31 set man-packed?
Yes, it was. It was about the size of that case of yours, only it was thinner.
Yes.
And it was you wore it on your back.
Yeah.
On a frame, which was a manpack frame, which was an aluminium frame. You strapped the set to it, and it had dry batteries, which were not chargeable, which you threw away when you'd finished with them.
So it's a sort of green metal box.
The green metal box. Yeah.
But presumably in your case, it would be mostly in a vehicle anyway, if you were...
It would be in a vehicle, yes, because the guns themselves, always you hoped you'd have vehicles, because carrying Vickers machine guns on your back was a pretty nugatory business. You'd only carry a small amount of ammunition with them, of course.
Well, there's always the serious problem with Vickers, isn't it? The ammunition consumption.
Yes. That was. And of course, the ammunition, the liners of 250 rounds per liner were heavy. And you got through it so fast that unless you had vehicles, quite honestly, you were wasting your time.
Yeah. How long were you actually in Tahuna on this case?
We were there for about. I joined them there, and I think I was there for about 6 weeks, I guess.
Yeah. What happened at the end of that?
Well, then we came back to Malta, which was where we were based, by which time it was Christmas time.
Same barracks as you've been in before?
Yes. Mm. Yes, it was the same barracks. And then it was Christmas, and then we were getting ourselves ready because we were going on a tour to Cyprus, which was then still in the throes of the EOCA emergency. And... For that, support troop became a rifle troop. And so the platoons became rifle platoons, effectively. And I was very lucky, because I was sent, when we got to Cyprus, we were up in the Troodos Mountains, and my platoon, with the assault engineer platoon, which didn't have an officer, was sent to a place called Kiko Monastery, which was in the Paphos Forest, and where I had a platoon base for 6 months, and I was the boss of this little base.
Had you done any specific training for this role before you got there?
Yes, we did. We did some workup training before we went in the sort of early part of the year, in January, after Christmas.
And of course, Christmas celebrations following the traditional pattern.
Yes, I mean, we had the traditional pattern, and that consisted of taking tea and rum to our troops in the morning. The officers would wake up their chaps with tea and rum. We'd then go and serve Christmas lunch to the chaps in the main dining hall. And we'd then repair to the sergeant's mess for much celebration. And then the officers would have their meal in the evening.
Did you get yours this time?
I got mine this time. I'd grown up a bit by then.
Very hard to resist the blandishments of the sergeant's mess.
Yes, but I decided discretion and all that sort of thing.
So that happened, and then is there anywhere in Malta that at all resembled where you were going in Cyprus?
Not really, because we were going to the Paphos Forest, which is very mountainous and covered with trees, and Malta is pretty flat and there aren't many trees there. So the sort of things we were doing in our training was what we now call vehicle checkpoints, VCPs. We were learning the faces. We had books of the wanted men with photographs. We were talking about anti-ambush drills, which you could practice, very low-level stuff.
Is this anti-ambush of vehicles?
Anti-ambush of vehicles, anti-ambush on your feet, cordon and search operations we could practice, a bit of night movement, but really pretty low-level stuff and not very sophisticated.
Had any of your chaps done this sort of thing before? Had they been involved in counterinsurgency?
Oh yes, because the commando had been in when I joined them in Tarhuna, they'd been in Cyprus in the earlier part of that year. So they'd actually, in those days, you went to Cyprus about once a year, because there were a lot of troops there, and the brigade was rotating people through, so there was usually a commando in Cyprus all the time. And so my chaps, except for reinforcements, had all been there before. In fact, they'd been to the same area, because they were up in the Troodos Mountains for their previous tour.
So you were deployed into Cyprus. How did you actually get there?
We went there by LSL. Not what I'm talking about, not LSL. I beg your pardon, not LSL. We went by LST, old Second World War LSTs, which were... There were two kinds of LSTs in those days. There were the grey ones owned by the Navy, and there were a whole stack of them owned by what was the British India Steam Navigation Company that ran the LSTs for the Army. And they were merchant ships. But they were used as troop and vehicle carriers. So the whole commando went across in and I can't remember how many LSTs, but I suppose about three or four to take all our vehicles and all our chaps. We certainly didn't fly, and it took about 5 days to get there, a very slow, wallowing trip to Cyprus. And then we went into Famagusta Harbour, and then got into trucks and drove up, and I was in the advance party, and I took over Kiko from the Royal Ulster Rifles. And what happened was everybody, because it took several days to get the commando there, I was just in the first LSL, so I got there ahead of everybody else. and the commander then staged through a camp outside Nicosia, a sort of
transit camp.
A transit camp. Mm. But I went ahead to take over from a platoon of the Royal Ulster Rifles, the RUR, strange lot they were.
Why were they strange?
Well, they were all mad Irishmen. They were quite fun, actually. They were quite different from Royal Marines, but they were, I mean, I'm sure, jolly good soldiers. But I was there for about 5 days, actually, taking over from them.
Were they able to give you a good and thorough briefing on what was going on in your area?
Yes, and they gave me a good tour around. And my area was about 80 square miles. Mm. It was, 10 by 8.
Yes.
And I had three villages in it, which I was responsible for. So they took me to all those, and they took me also to meet the acting abbot of the monastery, because the abbot was in exile with Makarios, because he was thought to be a Ioka supporter. And we lived in the pilgrims' accommodation for the monastery. I mean, there weren't any pilgrims, which were sort of low huts outside the main monastery.
What was the main monastery like?
Oh, a very impressive building. It had a very famous icon. It was Greek Orthodox, of course, and it was famous for this icon. I'm afraid I can't remember how old the icon was. I ought to be able to remember, but
I
can't.
Do you remember what saint it was, or what other?
I don't even remember that. Mm. But it was. I don't know how old it was, but I would have said it must have been several hundred years old, the monastery.
How many monks were in residence besides the
there were only about three or four, as far as I can remember, and they were all the older ones. And the chap in charge was a chap called Father Erasmus. I remember him. And the rest of them were all pretty old. The younger ones had all been carted off with their abbot, because they were all thought to be Ioka supporters.
What about Erasmus? Was he an Ioka supporter?
He pretended not to be.
He did.
And he was very sort of urbane. And occasionally would invite me to lunch and things like that. Mm. And he was always very polite and very... he was quite a worldly man, I think.
Mm. Now, you got 80 square miles. Was it all forested and mountainous?
All forest and mountain, yeah.
What was the road net like?
There was very few roads. There was a road going north-south through my area, which went through the monastery and then out to a village to the north of me and a couple of villages to the south of me. And then there was one that went more or less east, which joined up with the base where my troop commander was, a place called Pinewood Camp, and then went eventually to a place called Plartres, which is where command headquarters was. And the roads were unmetalled, unsurfaced rather, tracks effectively along which you could drive vehicles. I mean, they had a surface in that you could drive a bus along them, which was just sort of stones with huge drops on each side and cliffs on the other side sometimes, and so they were quite hairy driving along.
Were they sort of one-way carriageways, or
pretty much? I mean, if you met a bus coming around the corner, you had to give way.
Yes.
There was certainly no, and there was a lot of sort of manoeuvring had to go on. Yeah.
So these were Cornish roads, effectively, going...
I mean, I can show you a picture of the sort, if it would help, of the sort of road. Would that help? Shall I get it now? Or later?
Well, I think later would do.
Later. But I can show you. Yeah. And the worst bits were where you had a cliff like that and a road, and then it went down like that. And, for example, there was one bridge that was a particularly... hairy spot where you always were expecting to be ambushed, which was a wooden trestle bridge built into the side of the cliff, and only one vehicle could go along it at a time. And you were very conscious all the time that you were very susceptible to being ambushed if you were in a vehicle.
What kind of vegetation was the forest?
The forest was pine forest. It was. There were a few deciduous trees, but it was mostly pine. And the ground was all very shaly and rocky. Mm. There was very little. There were some bushes, but not much grass. Mm. But it was very much a combination of pine forest and maquis, I suppose, country, rather like the south of France.
I was going to ask, were the pines close packed? Because pine forests can be rather open in some parts of the world.
Indeed. On the sides of the hills, the pine forest was fairly open, but there were places when you got into a valley where the trees would be much bigger,
yes,
and it would be much more closely packed, yeah, and you'd almost get sort of glades,
yes,
like you do in some pine forest.
Well, a lot depends on how close they are, how far you can see into them.
Absolutely.
Because of the shadows.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
And did you have decent maps which showed the contours?
Yes. Yes, I've still got one actually, but the maps were, I think what they'd done, I mean the Eoka thing had been going now since the stage I was there for about 2 years, I suppose,
yes,
or 3 years, and so the mapping, I don't know what the maps were like at the beginning of the campaign, by the time I got there the maps were really pretty good. Mm. We had, I can't remember what scale they were, I think they were 150,000 scale.
The villages, you said three villages.
Yes.
What were they like?
They were pretty small, with just a sort of track going through the middle and then houses off to the side, and then there'd be the odd little sort of road, I wouldn't call it a street, off. And then at the centre of the village was the coffee shop, in which most of the men spent most of their time drinking coffee, as far as I can make out. And then there was always a tiny little church as well. And as far as I can remember, the source of income, they had goats, they had sheep, no cows, as far as I can remember, because the ground was too rocky. There was quite a big rose water industry, where there were fields full of roses, and they used to crush the petals and make rose water. There were some vines, there were olives. Carobs was another industry. The carob tree, which produces sort of things about that size, like rather hard olives that are crushed to produce oil. And I think that's about the sum total of the agriculture in that part.
Did they have actual pastures for the livestock, or were they just turned into the
just turned
woods?
Out into the mountain? Mm.
Presumably there was cultivation for the rose.
There was cultivation on terraces.
Yes.
For the rose. Yes, there was. Mm. Yeah.
Were these villages stone built?
Yes.
Mm. Well, what were the inhabitants? Were they Greek or Turkish?
Greek. I had all Greeks in my area.
All Greeks.
The Turkish area didn't start until some miles north of me.
How did they greet you when you turned up in these villages? Were they gruff and gruff?
On the whole, they were indifferent.
Yes.
And regarded one, I think, with a bit of suspicion, because this was a Greek area. Mm. And of course, they were terrified of the Turks.
Mm. Did the Ulster Rifles take you round to meet the mayors of these villages?
Yes. Mm. Yes. I can't remember what they were called. The mayors had a name. Mm. Mukhtars.
Mukhtar.
Mukhtars.
That's a Turkish word, isn't it?
Yes, well, I think it was. Remember that it had been a Turkish colony.
Ottoman legacy.
It had been an Ottoman until 1870. Yeah. So they had Mukhtars, yes.
Mm. What happened when you went to see a Mukhtar? How would things go normally?
Well, they'd be quite polite, and they'd give you a cup of coffee with a glass of water. Mm. Sometimes they'd dig out something to eat as well. Mm. Olives, usually. But they were pretty they were not very forthcoming, because they were frightened, you see, that if they were thought of being cooperating with us, that the Eoka chap would come round and kill them.
No one wants to be a collaborator.
No. And the police,
yes,
there was a policeman in each village who was a Greek.
Yeah.
And they were pretty useless too. Mm. And the only effective policemen were the Turks. Mm. And so there was a sort of Turkish special branch, which used to come with you sometimes, they were pretty heavy-handed actually.
Again, that's part of the Ottoman tradition, isn't
it? Yes. Yeah.
You mentioned the roads were very primitive and rather dangerous in places. What about other means of communication? Were there paths through the woods?
Oh, yes, yes. There were tracks and goat tracks and paths. And so you could. I used to do a lot of foot patrolling because, you know, going around on vehicles was pretty nugatory. And the best way of visiting a village unannounced was to go over the hills and just appear. So we used to spend a lot of time on our feet and got bloody fit too because the ground was very rough.
Yeah. What were your orders then when you were deployed into this area of 10 miles by 8? What were you supposed
to do? Well, what I was trying to do was to prevent Ioka ambushing vehicles, terrorizing the villages, and trying to make their life difficult, effectively.
So were you making their life difficult simply by being a presence in an area?
Yes, yes. And we used to do night ambushes on tracks that we thought they would use. And we would do snap searches of areas that we thought they might be in. And then, of course, occasionally there'd be a bigger operation, which would either be at troop or commando, or even bigger level, where we'd do what was known as cordon and searches of areas where we thought that there were Ioka guys inside.
And that sort of thing always depends, to a great extent, for success on intelligence.
Exactly. So yeah.
What sort of intelligence did you get when you moved into the area?
There was a special intelligence set up in Cyprus, based around the police special branch, but it had military guys seconded to it as well, and they would issue intelligence about Ioka to us. I didn't think the setup was all that good, quite frankly.
Why is that?
Well, I often found the intelligence wasn't terribly accurate.
Was it inaccurate or was it stale?
Both, I should say. I think the problem that that the intelligence people had was that the Greeks weren't cooperating on the whole. And though the Turks could go and beat information out of them, that wasn't actually a frankly clever way of doing it either.
Now, if you can't get actual factual intelligence hardened in an area like that, one way you can direct yourself is by deduction from study of the ground and the pattern of the enemy's previous behaviour, so that you can produce a sort of speculative idea of what they are likely to be doing, and that can help you to put your ambushes in the right places, search the right areas, and so forth. Were you doing that sort of thing?
Yes, we were. We were doing that. And a lot of it was based on the sort of things they'd done before. And so you knew, or you thought you knew, that they were going from village to village or going up to hides in the hills. And so your object was try and find them or find the routes that they'd used to get to them.
What was your estimate then of enemy strength in your area when you started your operations?
Not very many. I mean, I'm talking about tens rather than hundreds of people.
Yes.
Not many. I mean, Ioka had taken quite a battering in the sense that the original Wanted Men book was, you know, there were crosses across most of the pictures. And the stage we got there, we got issued with a new one, which had a whole lot of new faces in it. But I wouldn't have thought that in our area there were more than 10 or 15 of these guys.
Yes. And what was their armament and equipment like?
Small arms. They didn't have anything sophisticated or serious. Sort of Second World War Tommy guns, the odd rifle, carbine, pistol, that was about it.
And their quality? Were they trained men or?
No.
No.
I think a lot of their sort of hardest guys had been taken out. And I don't think they were all that good, actually. And the best way, the way they avoided us was by not doing anything. So they, you know, they didn't put themselves at any risk.
Well, of course, the guerrilla's first instinct is to survive.
Yes.
He can't absorb casualties. But material and psychological reasons.
No. I mean, I'm sure that their tactic was